Okay, want to welcome everybody to the Sloan Schwartz Center for Computational Neurobiology here at the Salk Institute. And we want you all to welcome Rodolfo Yanas, who's visiting from New York. Rodolfo is somebody who is a giant in our field. If you look up his entry in Wikipedia, he's called one of the fathers of neuroscience.
Legitimate or illegitimate?
Fathers are always legitimate, sir. You meant son.
It's the sons that you have to worry about, right? He has made many contributions, and I don't want to go down the entire list, but just to point out that it was Rodolfo who really was the first to understand the importance of low-threshold currents in the thalamus, which is really important if you're trying to understand sleep rhythms. He also was the one who understood how complicated Purkinje cells were, in particular the calcium currents and the P current. So our understanding of the intrinsic properties of these neurons and many others was really one of his gift to neuroscience. But he has many other interests, and he's written several popular books that I highly recommend. He has studied everything from squid giant synapses up to human oscillations, thalamocortical oscillations using MEG. He's a man for all seasons. I give you Rodolfo.
Thank you. Is this working?
Yeah.
It is. Great. Thank you very much. You're very generous, sir. I was invited to give a lab talk, and here we are. You have a big lab. Okay, I was thinking when I came that it would be lovely to talk, not necessarily about details, but some of the big picture issues, because they're actually, in some ways, more interesting. I mean, I love details, and I spend life, like all of you, doing details. But now, come on, life is short. You have to be able to say every so often exactly how you feel in public, for instance, in this case, with the advantage of being in California. I'm leaving tomorrow, so, you know, no problem. I won't be seeing you for a while, and when I see you again, I probably have changed my mind, so would have you. Maybe you wouldn't have forgotten about this, so okay. So what is the issue? I wanted to talk about intrinsic properties. And when I began physiology, by the time you began anatomy, we were about the same age, right? at that time, the brain worked as follows. There's a bunch of cells, they connect to each other, and there's either excitatory or inhibitory events, and the brain is passive until information, in quotes, comes in through the retina, through the auditory system, and so on. And then this information is carried from the outside world into the thalamus, let's say, into the cortex, if you're thinking about perception, and then a miracle happens. You see. And you see, of course, with the cortex, because that's where everything goes to. Now, suddenly something happened. People began to read a man called Ramon y Cajal, who had already described the fact that cortex returns with a vengeance back to the thalamus. This is something that has been rediscovered many times, actually. People have very short memory about anatomy, not only physiology. So the problem was then, well, it gets to the cortex, and then what? Well, it goes back to the thalamus. Mm-hmm. And then, well, it goes back to the cortex. So where and how do you see? And the only person that had a consistent hypothesis at that time was my professor, John Eccles. John Eccles had made the hypothesis that activity went from the thalamus to the cortex. At that point, psychokinesis took over, and actually address the activity of the cortex through the soul. The soul was, according to him, some sort of helmet that covered very thinly. I never really knew what thin means when you're talking about the soul, but anyhow, very thinly, the surface of the cortex. This that I'm telling you, I'm not inventing. It is true. If you look in 1952 Nature Journal, you'll find the hypothesis of how cognition is generated by John Eccles. Yeah, it was a couple of hypotheses. They were difficult to follow, but at least there was consistence. You go from A to B to Z, and then it happens, right? At the moment, we have beautiful physiology, beautiful anatomy, and no idea what the hell is going on. Except that maybe we will understand, but it won't be without effort. Okay, so what is it that I want to talk to you about? I wanted to discuss how intrinsic properties ultimately relate seriously to cognition. I always start all talks with this picture that I like. I love it for many reasons. I am only going to give you some of the reasons. Some of the other reasons are very private. The reasons are, this is Gabriella Sabatini, as I was saying to some of you last night, at her best, returning a drive from the other side. And of course, you all remember when you're learning to play tennis, this man telling you, or this woman telling you, look at the ball when you're about to hit it. Well, apparently that is only correct if you're learning to play tennis, because here, Gabriella Sabatini is not looking at the ball. And this is why I love this. Why? Because she's actually looking at the other side. She's looking at the other side of the field, over the net. Why? Because this event happens so fast that in order to be able to place the ball on the other side, you have to assume that you have actually hit the ball. So you are moving into the future. In fact, you perceive only the future. Here's this continuous ability we have to predict what is happening next. Not far in time, but recently. Yeah, so I'm about to touch this, and I know what's going to happen. No, I didn't actually know what was going to happen. It was supposed to change. Yeah, thank you. Okay. So fine. So what is it that is happening in a situation like this? What do we believe today? Well, one thing that we have learned is that, in fact, it is not correct to assume that all we have in our heads are neurons that integrate and fire. Rather, that having information, in quotes, coming into the brain, what seems to be happening is something totally different, which is, A, the brain has to be awake, B, the brain has to be paying attention, C, what you are probably doing with the input is modifying, resetting internal events. So, sorry, this is a point of view. You modify what is happening. The brain is always going. So you are specifying possible internal events as opposed to informing the brain about anything. How does it work? Well, this is a very beautiful drawing by a friend of Dr. Harvey. You probably, of course, knew this man very well, right? His name was Krieg. That's right. Krieg invented anatomy. That is, invented anatomy in the sense that what he drew is not necessarily what's there, but...
It's true.
It's true. I don't lie. I mean,
it was beautiful.
But it was beautiful. It was beautiful, and it is quite clear what he's saying. If these were tracks, which he says he's painting tracks, you find that yes, the system is stratified into a visual and a motor and a somewhat sensory and so on and so forth, and he puts colors and so on. But there are some things that are nevertheless true. The thalamus is located rather nicely centrally, more or less equidistant from the different parts of the cortex. So you can find thalamus somewhere in the back or something. So if cognition, if the functioning of the brain had something to do with simultaneity, that is, with time, the best thing would be to have the thalamus as a hub, such that the system could basically go anywhere. Now, if perchance you had this thalamus going somewhere and the activity coming back and bouncing something else and so on and so forth, you could see how you could actually mix the thalamic level all sorts of things. So you could do binding in at thalamic level. Of course, the next thing is, so how does the system function? And there are two schools of thought, and I, you know, again, I'm leaving tomorrow. So the one that people love is to imagine that cognition is cortical. They're called cortical chauvinists. The other people, the centroencephalic group, who believe that cognition must be actually more central, simply because cognition didn't happen with man, although we believe that we are the only cognitive event in the universe. So, okay, so choose your weapons. The advantage of having a huge cortex is that you can do a beautiful selection of information. You can actually have an enormous granularity of computation because the area is so expanded. So one area here, one very large area there. Great advantage. The other possibility, of course, is that the system in up on working returns to the thalamus, and this is nothing other than a CPU for the thalamus, if you like. A device that actually organizes information beautifully and then returns it to the dendrites of thalamus and to the reticularis, nucleus reticularis. So you can, you know, it is to be discussed. I seriously believe that cortex doesn't do very much as far as cognition is concerned for the following reason. If you have a lesion of the white matter, and the cortex is still alive, if you stimulate it, you don't feel anything. So the question is beautiful. Can the cortex feel? Obviously, not a proper question. Can the thalamus feel? Well, the problem is, how do you stimulate the thalamus in a manner that is comparable to the richness of the input back from the cortex? Can you have some sensation of the thalamus? The answer is yes. Some sensations, thalamic pain, things like that have been known for a long time. I'm not going to go into the meaning of qualia and exactly how is it that is organized, because life is too short. I don't have the time, fortunately. Besides, even if I knew, I wouldn't tell. I don't. Okay, so let's continue. So what is it that we can say today that is reasonable concerning how the system may work and how the intrinsic properties may be important in how it works? Well, if you look at the cortex in the most general of terms, you will remember that in the vertebrate nervous system, when there is the dorsal thalamus, for the most part, comes into the cortex and ends in layer 4. This is the bulk of the input. There are other things that happen. You also know that the non-specific, basically the old thalamus, actually have inputs that go to the surface as well as to layer 6 and layer 5. But they go to the surface. So these two elements are actually quite nicely separated. The hypothesis has been, therefore, that in order to have proper workings of the thalamocortical system, you have to have activation of the specific and the non-specific systems. I'll give you some reasons why that is the case. Some of these big issues that it's difficult to argue against, which is the ones that you really like to play with. Okay. So you have specific and so-called non-specific. This is just a way of not saying the truth. It is specific up to a point. It is just not as granular as the other one is. So not all cells of the central thalamus go to all parts of the cortex. Now, if we look at the connectivity in general, the sort of things that we all work with, we can put together a circuit of more or less of this type, where specific inputs, specific, by specific it is meant inputs that arise either from the lateral genicular, the medial genicular, whatever, any one of the specific inputs that relate to well-defined sensory inputs to the brain. In the case of the retina, let's say retina comes into the thalamus, projects back to the nucleus reticularis, which is inhibitory, so you have the first inhibitory event happening right at the cortical level, at the thalamic level, and then up to the cortex in layer 4, and in layer 4, inputs going to the cortex and going to an enormous number of through interneurons. And, of course, the very important and very popular inhibitory interneurons, which we know so well, and we actually have learned to love so much. So this input is the new input. It's the input that came with vertebrates. With mammals, pardon me, lower vertebrates do not really have something that's elaborated. They're mostly, or many of them have only three layers, as many of you know. So this is called the content thalamus. It's just a word. It means what? It means that this is the system that brings into the cortex a whole lot of information, most of which you don't use. And we were saying last night, for those of you who are there, you know, we all know that we have shoes on, but you only feel them if somebody points out the fact that your shoes have been soiled or something like that. So you feel them, right? But otherwise, you don't, although information is coming in all the time. So attention is very important. So this is the system that brings information, believe, to the brain, but it doesn't force itself into cognition. It is simply there. There's another system, the old system, that is represented by so-called non-specific, which I thought would be nice to call the context, because it is the system that actually brings into cognition those aspects of perception that are important for what one is doing at this particular moment. So you have a content and a context system. The question is, how could they work? And of course, being interested in intrinsic properties, being interested in time, the immediate possibility is that we're talking about a device that is capable of binding in time with the very measurements, or with the very concept we have about neuronal integration. That somehow the system is organized as to be able to have coherent events that in some way represent the properties of the external world at any particular time. And it would be particularly nice if somehow the two could find each other somewhere. What is possible and what you need to know about what is possible. This is, in fact, what you need to know about what is possible. Now, what does this system look like? Well, it is midline. Thalamus is also thalamus that goes out and is related to a specific thalamus as well. Jones has been working on this for a long time, and he has, in fact, proceeded to go beyond central nuclei, intermedian and the interlaminar and so on. So these are both rather large. Now, the nice thing about this system is that it doesn't receive that much information directly from the outside. Rather, information they receive comes mostly from intermediate cortices, from those cortices that are not primary receptors to external information. So these are called associative cortices. So if you do lesions to almost any aspect or any part of the association cortex, let's say the parietal cortex or the temporal cortex or the frontal cortex, you're mostly having problems that relate to this so-called non-specific system. Now, it begins to tell you how the system could work. Activity coming in from specific nuclei, going, basically representing what is happening. The association cortices putting into context, having some sort of preceding immediate image of what is going on. Addressing those aspects that are important to whatever is happening at the time, in almost in a Bayesian sense, you know, basically predicting information by generating states that are likely to occur given what had happened immediately before. So the basic hypothesis then would be that in order to have the system work together, you have to have specific and non-specific systems being coherent in time onto the large pyramidal cells of the cortex. If this is the case, then the fact that these pyramidal cells have this very beautiful long dendrite makes an enormous amount of sense, because it's in fact these neurons that bind in time, that integrate information at a particular time. The hypothesis would be something like content and context must find each other, and they find each other on the integrative properties of the apical dendrite. Okay. So, there's the other problem that is very intriguing. These cells are not simply working based on synaptic transmission, but they mostly work based on their own intrinsic properties. That is, neurons have a point of view. They're not just sitting there waiting to have an input. If you're coming the wrong time, you won't be listened to. I'm out to lunch type thing. Or, yes, nice. Now, what does this mean? It means like the heart itself, neurons have electrical activity that belongs to them independently of synaptic input. We all know that. This is not a place to have to say this loudly because you all work on it. Okay, so this is This is the thalamic neuron. We found the thalamic neuron, something that we had found before in the inferior olive, which is that there is oscillatory properties that are neither action potentials nor synaptic potentials that are generated by something that is now known as the T-channel, KV3, whatever, which allows these neurons to continuously oscillate, to continuously be organized in time, I mean, to have a time presence, or to have some sort of clocking device, if you like. The advantage of having something like that is enormous. Why? Because if you want to have coherence, if you want to have neurons capable of generating computational objects, to have neurons that have similar rhythmicity allows for coherence a lot simpler. That if they didn't, I bet, like when you have a system of interlocking wheels and the wheels have teeth. So it is a beautiful way to produce coherence. Now, what are these coherent events? Well, we'll see it in a moment. They relate to a particular type of channels that are now well studied. We know them by name, we know them by family, we know where they come from, we know the sequence of each one of the elements in the peptide, the long chain that generates the channels. Okay. So what is this all about then? This is an injected thalamic cell. You remember it has an upper dendrite and a lower dendrite and so on. This is in vitro in guinea pig thalamus. And you find what we were talking about a moment ago. Terry was mentioning the fact that we found that if you have a cell that is a little depolarized from rest, the cell can fire tonically. That if the cell is hyperpolarized, it begins to fire in a burst fashion. And this is interesting physiologically, but it's crucial to brain function. Why? If your thalamus has this particular state, you cease to exist. Meaning you are asleep, like, no, I don't see anybody yet. Okay. So what happens if you fall asleep? Well, you cease to exist. I mean, everybody else see you, but you don't hear. You don't remember the grant, your paper, whatever. You don't exist. You are nothing but a functional state of your brain. So this channel that we love and we work and we sort of spend our lives trying to patch and trying to... Is it? We smell blood. I smell blood all the time and I love it. So, yes. So we have a cellular mechanism that correlates absolutely with the absence or presence of cognition. In this situation, no cognition. You are asleep. Now, we know that sleep's not that simple. You've been studying it. Law has been studying it. A lot of people are studying it. It isn't simple, but we know that it's going to be the interplay between the electrical, intrinsic electrical properties of neurons and the circuits they weave. Okay. Now, all of you have seen this before, but let me just remind you. No, it's the next one. Now, in addition to this, you get complaints from everywhere. In addition to these low frequencies that we've been talking about, there is something else that, again, we found some years ago, which is when you depolarize the membrane, when you depolarize, pardon, the cell, you don't depolarize the membrane, you depolarize the cell, you find that in addition to the very slow type activity that I'll show you in a moment, there is also a high-frequency oscillatory event that lives about a gamma frequency. It is actually very nice. You see it appearing as you depolarize further and further, and we now know that this gamma band activity is supported by P channels. So animals with no P channels have no such thing. Okay, so gamma band. We also know that interneurons in the cortex are capable of gamma band subthreshold oscillations. And the pyramidal cells also have gamma band subthreshold oscillations. So we are poised following. We're saying it is indeed possible that the system, when activated, is such that a particular rhythmicity that would happen at a multicellular level is already set by the resting potential of the cells, of the elements that are going to become bound in time. This is very important because if this binding has to do with frequency and time, then this is something that should be ensured, it should be selected for. Now, just to make sure that we know what we are talking about, you probably have seen this film before. This is McCormick's film showing the properties of these neurons. This is a cell that is oscillating at low frequency and then depolarizes for whatever reason. And it changes completely its ability to work. It is a totally different functional event. And then it goes, hypolarizes, and the T channels reappear. In one case, the animal is capable of cognition, in the other one, it is not. This is something like slip spindle. So it happens in a dish, in a single cell. So we are talking about properties that are not just the product of connectivity. We're talking about the fact that neurons indeed are far deeper than we ever imagined, which is wonderful. Because if it's just computation, we end with the problem is, okay, so where is vision occurring? We haven't. In other words, we have a lot to do yet. Electrophysiology is necessary, anatomy is necessary, but neither electrophysiology or anatomy alone is sufficient. Okay. And now, this is a figure that we just published last year and with Misha Steriade just before he died. We decided to have this review, and I was telling Misha, you know, I would love to put in this review a simple story. And the simple story is something that you would love, that when you look at the electrical properties of thalamic neurons, they're exactly the same. in fish, in frogs, in turtles, in birds, and in mammals. They have the same channels. They have the same properties. If you depolarize the fire repetitively, this freak, somebody was saying, what about the difference in frequencies? Forget it. It's, if you depolarize a little bit more, the frequency increases. It's just a question to say, if you depolarize beyond a certain level, all of this type of this category of saline, all of these animals behave exactly the same. They're capable of tonic firing. If you hydropolarize, they have an H current, and what's more important, they have a T current. So they all have this rebound event. They all have gamma band activity when you depolarize it. All of them have gamma band activity. TTX and so on, yes, definitely T channels. They all have low frequency oscillation. So the next question, of course, is, so, you know, maybe they are capable of cognition. And, of course, there are the two people who say, of course. And the other people says, what do you mean? We eat them. I say, no, it's okay. They still are capable of cognition. They just can't do anything about it. Okay, so seriously, this is very lovely because it really basically means that these are things that are conserved. They evolved a long time ago. And that what we're seeing with evolution probably is simply more of the same. I mean, it is quite clear that what we see is very different to what one of these lower vertebrates may see. But we both run away from danger more or less at the same speed. Actually, they do better than we do for the most part, except for frogs because they jump. Anyhow, it's just thoughts that come to mind. Okay. So now the next question is, okay, but we've been talking about thalamocortical. Is the thalamocortical system really works anything like one is proposing? Well, one way of trying to understand this is use slides where the slice is has all of the cortex and the thalamus and basal ganglia and so on. And you have CL, central lateral, which is interlaminar, and you have BV, which is, of course, the somatostatic, somatosensory input to the viral cortex, all in a slice. And then you put some voltage-dependent dye imaging. Or thing, you basically dye the system, and you ask simple questions like, if you stimulate different parts, what does the physiology look like? Is the physiology look like the anatomy? Are we really talking? Is the anatomy we're talking real? And I'm not going to bother you. You all know this is a voltage-dependent fluorescent event, and so on. You all use it. So. Okay, so first point is, if we look at the cortex only, and we stimulate the white matter immediately underneath, anywhere in the cortex, we can actually stimulate at low frequency, let's say 10 hertz or lower, and maybe gamma band or lower. And something really beautiful happened. I mean, this. No questions asked. You do, as I say, one stimulus at low frequency, meaning you give a stimulus, then you get 100 milliseconds, you go another stimulus, and so on. When you give 10 hertz, so you give simply one stimulus, what you find is the input to the cortex comes in, it activates basically a strip of the cortex, basically a column. And then it diffuses out. It moves out. And you do 10 hertz, and it basically comes in and moves out. You know, it is a very large, rather boring event, if you like. If you put another stimulus, you have very much the same. If you put two stimuli, you find that, again, same thing happens. It moves in time. Now, what happens if you do gamma band? Could there be a change there? And of course, you know that when you do gamma band at 40 hertz, the activity stays. What does that mean? It means the following. He means that frequency generates geometry. The system is coded for frequency. What does this mean? At gamma band, the activity remains and it is columnar. What is this columnarity due to? The interneurons, inhibitor interneurons, if you block gamma, this columnarity disappears. So we say, okay, we have the frequency, we have the connectivity, we have the channel to make this stuff. We see that the oscillatory properties, that the time constraint generates, is not interesting because it has a certain frequency. It is interesting because of the functional states they generate. So, in fact, when we are awake, and stimuli apparently generate very thin, very beautifully punctate activity. Do we know that to be the case? We know that to be the case now for human beings. I don't know if you've seen Tononi's paper, where he stimulates a magnetic stimulator, and he finds that if you're awake, you stimulate, you have a very localized activity, but if you are asleep, the whole thing goes. Now, it ceases to have that particular geometry. Lovely. Okay. Next. So let's go back, and now instead of stimulating immediately underneath the white matter, let's stimulate the thalamus. This is, in fact, the slide of Luhmann. I was in Germany, and he produced this slide, and he says, can I please have it? And he kindly gave it to me. And it's, you know, it's a mouse, and you put some stuff in the cortex, and it's transported backwards, and you see the pathways, and you see BV, you see the reticular nucleus, and you see not so much activity in the basal ganglia, but it gives you this coma-like structure. I say, but you know, I love it because when you have the same type of prep still alive and you have a voltage-dependent activity present, when you stimulate, what you get is exactly that. This actually happened before. I had seen the particular picture. So if you stimulate CL, intriguingly, you have activity there. You have a very nice activity located in the nuclear reticularis. I was amazed. I had forgotten how important that input is to basal ganglia. It goes with a vengeance to the basal ganglia. It also goes to layer 1. And it also goes to layer 5 and 6. Okay. And then you stimulate ventrobasal. Again, you see ventrobasal, you see reticularis, not so much basal ganglia. And then you see the area that is missing here, there. Basically, layers 4, 3, 2. So it is roughly correct. What happens if you put the two together? Well, roughly speaking, if you put the two together, especially at gamma band, you get an enormous amount of activity. Ah, this is the wrong slide. Sorry about that. Never mind. Imagine for a minute that rather than having this cut here, which is a response to a question somebody asked me once, the real slide would basically show you what happens on the top, what happens on the bottom, what happens if you put the two together, and the fact is that the system then becomes recursive. You have, if you put the two systems together, the system then can support activity, but it has to be at 40 hertz. It has to be gamma band. The basic idea then, it's an old idea we've been discussing, is the fact that possibly what you need for binding is that the specific and non-specific systems should act on the same dendrite or similar set of dendrites in pedaminal cells. So it assumes that there is coincidence detection and that cognition is nothing more and nothing less than a large coincidence detection entity. This requires, of course, that this dendrite be capable of coincidence detection. So the idea was, okay, we have here an input. This is one EPSP, this one here. The other one on the top, producing another EPSP. When you put the two together, the cell can fire. So this is why there is this long dendrite. So characteristic of the cortex. Hypothesis. The question is how to demonstrate it. And, of course, there came Matthew Larkin. And this is one of these gorgeous experiments, you know. When you are totally gifted as a physiologist, you can do this kind of thing. And you probably all know the paper. It's basically a patch clamp of the soma, patch clamp in the middle of the dendrite of the same soma, and patch clamp of the upper part of the dendrite. So you have three patches. Okay, and then you can do two things. You can simulate on top the electrode, and you get a local depolarization of the membrane and a smaller depolarization of the dendrite and almost no activity at the soma. It stays up there. You stimulate antidromically the cell, and you get back propagation. And then what you have is the action potential here, and then some potential at the dendrite and some potential at the point where the tuft ends. Now, the tuft is this area on the top of the cell that is increases the area of reception, of course, receives input from layer one, among other things. Now, what happens if you stimulate together? If you stimulate together, this is A, B, D, you see a huge facilitation. The system really binds beautifully the two inputs, and you produce this very large response. So there is a time window where actual summation can occur. Now, this may not be as nicely seen as what I'm going to show you now, which is a little clip of what actually happens. So we have, this is the non-specific, the top of the dendrite, stimulus moving in time. You notice this is the EPSP, it's no problem. At a particular moment, puff, you get. And then it moves away. So timing and coincidence is central. It is true.
Which have to be first?
No. No. They just have to, the membrane potential has to be elevated at some point. It's really what it boils down to. Okay, so fine. So fine, okay. So specific and non-specific, it may be in fact the case. And what else do you have to bring to the party? Said, well, Federico Fellini. Of course, he's always invited to any good party. Federico Fellini. You remember Federico Fellini is actually somebody who makes movies, right? Okay. Do you know him as anything else?
Sorry.
Do you know him as anything else? No. Okay. Federico Fellini actually had a damage to the parietal lobe at some point, and he got hemineglect. What does that have to do with anything? Everything. The guy gets hemineglect.
But was this before or after he was ill?
After, fortunately. Yeah. He's an intelligent man, and he has some wonderful things to say about hemineglect. I'll show you some of the drawings he made. The drawings are actually very scary in some ways. So you have this damage of the, in this case, parietal cortex. The person has hemineglect. You remember hemineglect, the strange neurological condition where half of the universe is lost to you. You see only half of things. You know, see clocks from 12 to 6. You recognize this hand, and when whose hand is that? I don't know. Is it yours? He said, of course it's not yours. It must be yours, doctor. Right? What do you mean? Don't you see that I have two hands? They have two, only two hands? He says, that's not true. You know, you have three hands because you have three arms. That arm is not mine. You're here and I'm here. Who is it going to belong to? Right? So there is not only half, no perception, but there is anosognosia. You don't know. There is another half, and you don't miss it, which is the most scary thing I can imagine, that you don't see it.
It's not, I can say it, you can't see it. But that you don't know that it's missing. He says, what else don't we know we're missing? You know, it's absolutely terrifying. Anyhow, the intriguing part about this patient is that if you put a caloric stimulation in one ear, that is, if you increase the amplitude of the activity of the vestibular system, they wake up. So they suddenly see everything. Now, I had one such patient, so I actually went and talked to this woman over and over, and we did the experiment over and over. No recognition, no pain, no nothing. Have the body is not there, and have the person. Everything is only half. You can't see anything. You stimulate, then suddenly the person sees everything. And he asks, what am I? He says, what am I? You've been talking. He says, what is going on? He says, what's going on, dear, is that you have him neglect and so on. And whose hand is this? He says, what do you mean, whose hand? This is my hand. Perfect. 2 or 3 minutes later, the effect of the stimulation disappears. So we go back to whose hand is this? What it means? Nothing to do with me. Doesn't remember that a few minutes ago, person knew. Then you try again, and the thing happens. Oh my God, what am I doing here? Whose hand is this? This is my hand. Do you remember this? I've always had two hands. The generation of self-image, of cognition, apparently is really that labile. And if you don't have certain information, you deny it. It's not there. There is only, you know, there is no more than just this stuff. Okay, so with experiments were done in this man, he has a very interesting event. First of all, this is one of these beautiful drawings that only a very bright person can make. And that is, he has this, as is this supposed to be or something? This is one of these impossible issues. Because although this person has hemineglect, he knows that something horrible lives at the other side. That if he goes up the stairs, he may fall into something that is not just black, it's nothing. So there's this awe of nothing. And these persons are wondering, oh my God, may I not fall into this sort of Hades, this horrible situation? Okay. So there is some knowledge that something is very wrong. The other thing that is nice, of course, he likes wine. And if you present him with a map of France, you find that before vestibular stimulation, you say, well, look, okay, these are the chateaux that I like. You give stimulation of the vestibular, and then all of them appear. So this is real. Now, what is going on? What is going on is that apparently the midline thalamus is not working in that side. Now, we've done some experiments, and we find that, indeed, the connectivity of retina to the cortex and so on in the side that is hemineglect is there. The information is there, but there is no context for the information, hypothesis. Now, how do you know this properly? Well, there is this. Not a very good picture because it's a very old picture. Oh, by the way, you can get hemineglect also in animals. You know, normal animals can move to the left or the right. If you do hemineglect, just neglect that side. The same place, parietal cortex. if you remember giving a lecture, and then it was Heilman, who's one of the great neurologists United States now, and he said, you know, I have this patient that had what I consider to be a lesion in the midline thalamus, and this person had hemineglect. And apparently such patients do not respond to vestibular input. So probably what vestibular input is doing is depolarizing the midline thalamus such that coherence can occur again. Okay, well, these are speculations with patients and with electrophysiology and so on. But can we do some electrophysiology in people? And the answer is yes. And, we have this MEG, which I thought was the obvious extension of microelectrode work. So we can actually work with our students as not just people who do the experiments, but actually as subjects. So you tell them, don't worry, it doesn't do anything. The only thing, it may fall, but it's so well. Otherwise, this It's nothing. It's just like putting your head against a wall or something, you know. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't release anything. It measures magnetic activity. You have one here, and I know you work very continuously with it. And it is a beautiful system to measure things with. And roughly speaking, you all remember, you can measure the electrical activity of cells two ways, either by the change in electric field that you have between one point and another, that is a potential difference between two points. This is extracellular potentials, or EEG or something. Or else, you can look at the magnetic fields produced by the intracellular longitudinal current. You remember all current comes into the membrane through the intracellular milieu out to the external world. The current density is maximally inside the core conductor because it has to be all there and then it's completely diffused onto a very large space. So the highest current density is in the core conductors, and in this particular case, the dendrites of the pyramidal cells. So it is possible to see without, not as a different potential, but the actual current by the magnetic field that the current generates. And you remember the right rule, there's the current and magnetic field, those are right angles. So the question is, do you have magnetic fields if the cells are always perpendicular? And the answer is, we have done it very carefully. Now, with a few degrees already from perpendicular, you already see a magnetic field, and besides, there are other dendrites and so on. No problem. The fact is, there is no blind spot. And people were afraid of that. There isn't any to speak of. That's what I was just telling you. There's a core conductor moving left to right. It generates an electric field, positive or negative. As it moves, it generates at right angles to a magnetic field with a source and a sink, which basically is circular. Okay. Now, if you put a person in this MEG and you simply look at the activity when the person is awake, you find that there is, of course, an alpha rhythm. This is fast Fourier transform, and this is power. So the power is such that you have an alpha rhythm, you have maybe a beta rhythm, you have a gamma rhythm, and this is part of another experiment, which I don't bother with you with. So, yeah, you can see the same frequencies that you see in cells. This is remarkable. What? You know, this has been known for a long time, but suddenly the intrinsic properties of neurons are the things that you see. The system doesn't produce any possible type of oscillations. The system is really beautifully locked into a particular type of energy activity, frequency activity. It's not, somebody says, are the waves important? It says, the waves are not important. The waves are epiphenomena. It's the geometrical organization of activity that this thing is about, which, of course, produces waves. I don't know why I get angry. I know why I get angry, because people think that waves are things. Okay. Skipping through a whole lot of things. I'm dropping my euros. My God. You didn't see that. So, what happens? I didn't bring more slides than this, so this is what I'm showing you, what I have. We were discussing the possibility that changes in rhythmicity may be related to certain neurological conditions. And the story, putting it in very general terms, is straightforward. What were to happen to you if, when you wake up or you fall asleep, rather than doing it completely, let's say you wake up and you see but you can't hear because the system is not functioning properly. Well, you'd be in trouble. You know, it happens to all of us that we don't see so well or we don't hear so well, but everything is there when we wake up. So what happens if you have a part of your thalamus that remains at low frequency? And why would that happen? Well, we decided to look at pathology, and there was, of course, very good reason to look at certain things. The first thing we looked at was Parkinson's. Parkinson's is a well-defined motor problem. We look at the overall frequency of frequency spectrum of this is graduate student. Oh, good. They generally have very beautiful alpha rhythm. You close, you open your eyes, it disappears. This is a set of Parkinson's patients. This, by the way, is a logarithmic scale. So these patients have low frequency, very abnormally so.
This is
thalamus? This is MEG. It's recorded. So you're recording.
It's localized to where?
So this is just, at this point, just looking at what kind of stuff comes out, right? We'll get into more detail, but so basically, you can see immediately something wrong. This is not the type of profile that a normal person has. Now, you can look at patients, you find that, yeah, it divides very nicely into groups. So there's a good correlation between abnormal, what we would consider thalamocortical activity, in these patients. Okay. Now, where is it localized? And then your ICA comes up. Well, generally, activity is localized in supplementary motor area and premotor area and motor cortex. And you see very nice points of activity. This is low frequency. This, by the way, disappears if you get rid of the Parkinson's. And in fact, one way that it's possible these days is to do magnetic stimulation. You go puff, 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 and you reset everything, and the tremor disappears, and this goes away. But anyhow, I'll show you more about that in a minute. Okay. Something is happening with the dynamics of the thalamocortical activity in the motor system. Patients that go into this kind of activity generally have a problem of tone. They are basically very rigid. Those who have problems here have problems initiating movement. The people that have only cortical, and we have a whole lot of these things, are those that mostly have problems with the execution. They have a tremor to begin with, and then they can't bring in proper movement. Although, if you play music at the right tempo, or if you put lines in the floor, all of this disappears. So we have played music, and this disappears. Now, of course, you want to nail it a little bit more. So one way to do it, of course, is a lot of these patients go to surgery. And they go to surgery because the L-DOPA treatment ceases to work after a while. They begin to have hallucinations and so on and so forth. So something has to be done. And the last resort is you go to your friendly neurosurgeon and you say, could you get rid of this monkey that I have? And he says, yes, well, you shave your head, make holes in your skull. This is really terrible. I shouldn't say that. But why not? I mean, I wouldn't want it done on me. Anyhow, you make these holes in the cranium and then you put electrodes down, and this is the thing we were talking about a moment ago. Put electrodes, and then you can do several things. One of the things is you can record. And the first thing that happens when you record is that you find thalamic neurons doing that. So we know what's going on. Thalamic neurons are hyper. Pardon me?
The time scale?
The time scale. Oh, Lord, it's missing. This is a Jamonos. This is about 6 hertz. But you notice the rhythmicity, which is actually beautifully correlated with the tremor in this particular case. So you know absolutely that these neurons are generating low frequency activity. You can see them now. This has been done now by everybody. This is a well-known fact now. Okay. So you continue down, and you get to the proper place, and you stimulate. Now, the next question is, what happens if you get Parkinson's of another part of the thalamus? Because basically what we're saying is that Parkinson's is due to the fact that there's an abnormal rhythmicity in the motor thalamus and the cortex associated with it. So we find depression, obsessive compulsive disorders, epilepsy, especially perimal epilepsy, this has been known for a long time, neurogenic pain, tinnitus, dystonia, spasticity, Parkinson's. There's a whole lot of stuff. And the question is, okay, what the hell are you talking about? No, one size fits everything. And then the answer is, well, you know, we're sorry. If you happen to be a neurologist and you were asked what kind of prodromic, that is what happens before epilepsy, what kind of events can precede epilepsy? If you are about to have epilepsy, you have a moment before that when something happens. And this kind of prodromic events can be visual, can be auditory, can be anything. Implying what? That a whole lot of events can happen under those conditions. And the difference is where the mechanism apparently is exactly the same. So the hypothesis here is all of these diseases, although have been, some are psychiatric and the others are neurological, at the moment there's some disagreement because what you mean that psychiatry has to do with the brain, some neuropsychiatrists don't believe in the neuro part. Anyhow, so if this is correct, and some of us think it's correct, we are saying there's a whole lot of neurology and psychiatry that is simply due to our improper activity in the thalamocortical system. Can you show it? Can you demonstrate it? And the answer is, well, yes, there are many ways of doing it, and this is one of these intriguing cases that you can find. This is somebody that has a dystonia, and it has this young woman that has this arm all basically in that particular shape all the time, and it's almost impossible to move. Doesn't respond to anything. Is it possible to put an electrode on the brain and get rid of this? Well, in fact, we have even a better case than this one. And there is a young man that has bilateral dystonia. And then this is Ali Rizai's work. He's one of my students. He's down at Cleveland Clinic, who actually decides to put two pacemakers and actually stimulate at high frequency the field of Pharrell, basically producing reduction of inhibition. You remember the field of Pharrell carries the axons of the globus pallidus internus onto the thalamus. So he puts these two things, which can be turned on and off externally by a trigger device. So this is the two electrodes in place. And what happens is what you see here. This is a young person that has a terrible problem with dystonia. This person is activating first the first stimulus, and notice what happens. Then the second system, and you see that it immediately disappears, and the problem is gone. What are you doing? You're changing the rhythmicity. Does it work? It works. How quickly does it work? As quickly as electrophysiology works. You turn it off, it goes back. Yeah, and he's a very happy camper. This is really moving. The guy is actually very nice. So he has his two pacemakers, and he's controlling his abnormal thalamocortical activity. Is his motor? Can you show thalamocortical dysrhythmia, which is what we're calling this? In another area. The answer is yes, tinnitus. You remember tinnitus, you damage your auditory nerve, you are completely deaf, but there is this sound coming in all the time, and sometimes the sound is impossible. It's like having a trumpet played on all the time. So these people sometimes actually go to the point of committing suicide. Forget it, this is terrible. in some cases, this is one of such patients, the tinnitus can be masked, by putting an auditory stimulation. So you put your earphones, you simulate, and then suddenly there's no more tinnitus. And then you get this, you put the person MEG. This is in red, the activity, the frequency versus power, when the stimulus is off. And this is what happens when you turn on the stimulus. You see a very clear change of basically theta, and of course the high frequencies as well. Subtract it to and localize it. It's localized at the auditory cortex. Okay, so what do we have? A beginning understand on serious hypothesis of what may be going on in cognition. When you have the time coherence activity between specific and non-specific systems. Now, this is the hypothesis we are working with. And the lovely thing is that you can go from single channels up to behavior. In fact, so what are we doing? We're doing very much the same as many of you may be doing it, is you're getting animals that have knockouts of channel A or channel B and channel C, and we, of course, find that all of this is beginning to come out. So it may be correct. Now, it's interesting because, again, it underlines the importance of the intrinsic properties of neurons. In this case, we've decided to call this syndrome the thalamocortical dysrhythmia syndrome, and the thalamocortical dysrhythmia syndrome has two components. Negative symptoms, in the case of Parkinson's, let's say, you can move, associated with the positive symptoms. For instance, you cannot move, but you have tremor. And we believe that to be related to the presence of low frequency and associated coherent gamma band. This has now been confirmed in humans for tinnitus. So positive and negative symptoms are just the electrophysiology that we do every time we sit in front of our rigs and we take a slice or something. The bottom line is, yes, we're getting close. Yes, we who do neuroscience, we who do channels, we who do whatever, are the key to understanding the nature of the problem, whether it be pathology, whether it be something about perception itself. Okay, and the next thing is my colleagues, wonderful colleagues I have. You probably all remember Sugimori. We've been together for umpteen thousand years, like almost 35 years. Yossi Yaron, intracellular recording and oscillations. Janssen, thalamus, Paul Rhodes does, of course, computational analysis. Nambu, basal ganglia, Contreras, cortical, thalamocortical, Christina Pedro-Erna, the thalamic, Elena Lesnig and Francisco Urbano also have done. Is doing at the moment, thalamocortical. And then MEG was Ribery, which is my colleague in MEG, Kankro, the head of psychiatry, general neurosurgeon, Janis Volkman, neurologist, Elie Wiesel, neurosurgeon, Schulman, Ray Ramirez, who's here. He's a fantastic guy. He's got his PhD on MEG. Craig Hornstein, Kimberly Moran, and Kevin Sauvay. Okay, so this is what I wanted to tell you about. I see you, Harvey.
In a minute.
Uh-huh.
So what about if you have this thalamic oscillation occurring in the anterior nucleus of the thalamus, which projects into the prefrontal cortex? Do you get other types of symptoms there?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. We have three syndromes that relate to that area. One is schizophrenia. The other is obsessive-compulsive disorders. And the other one is depression. And yeah, we're just finishing some papers on it. So, right. Well, I didn't expect less from you. Got between the eyes. Right.
Good.
Yes,
Scott.
Is the intervention in thalamus the only place that in this circuit that will...
Actually, it's really not in the thalamus. What you do is you go through the thalamus onto the field of Forel. You may remember the field of Forel are the axons of the lobus valgus internus. So you get to basically about the middle of the pathway, which is very tiny, and you stimulate it at about 180 hertz, which basically means you're getting rid of those terminals because there's no synapse that can follow 180 hertz for the rest of your life. So you basically are turning off inhibition that comes from basal ganglia onto the thalamus. So the thalamus immediately depolarizes and it begins to work. You can also make a lesion on and get the same thing. So now, can you do it somewhere else? Yeah, well, the horror, because it's a very beautifully charged question. You know, when a neurosurgeon began to do Parkinson's patients, the neurosurgical treatment was to remove the motor cortex.
I have
the papers. So you have this problem. He says, okay, we'll remove the motor cortex. You have this sort of arm, but at least it won't be sort of, you know. That's exactly the same thing. No, but this is true. This is what happens with people that have schizophrenia. What you do, let's remove the frontal lobe. But this frontal lobe is not the problem. You can actually do the same thing as you can do with Parkinson's and some schizoaffective disorders and some schizophrenia. Remove the hypopar... Hey, Ray, you're here. Okay. All you have to do is remove the inhibition such that the thalamus can depolarize and function properly.
Then what do you think about is the etiology of the disorder? How does this inhibition...
Okay, so in the case of Parkinson's, I think the issue is very well known. You have a sensory nigra damage. Dopamine is not released anymore. Lobus pallidus fires all the time. And you know you record from the lobus pallidus of a Parkinson's patient, the activity is very high. So what's happening? The thalamus is being hyperpolarized all the time. So now T channels are activated. You know, they are not inactivated anymore. So in that case, you remove that inhibition, the whole thing comes up immediately. Now, in the others, well, it could be that there's excess inhibition, or the other possibility is that there is deafferentation. For instance, you damage the auditory system. The auditory system ceases to be active. The background activity on the thalamus reduces. The cells hyperpolarize. You don't hear because the cells are simply not being active. And there's no input, but they have oscillatory frequencies. So, again, now, this treatment is now being used almost universally now for tinnitus. It's really very successful.
Sure. What's charming about the picture you've painted is its generality. And I was struck by the story you told about tinnitus and failure of auditory function. And I wonder if there isn't a way, will your theory predict some possible deficits that we rarely encounter, in fact, for some reason or other, perhaps because the thalamocortical integration doesn't get interrupted in those areas, but if we could artificially interrupt, we'd produce a new pathology. And it occurred to me in the case of vision, shouldn't there be an analog to tinnitus in the case of vision if there were a comparable thalamocortical failure to integrate and there'd be something like visual tinnitus?
Absolutely. Now, I don't know of any. Yeah. I'm not really a neurologist, you know, a physiologist. So. But what we do know is that in cases where people have visual hallucinations, that you can get activity not so much in the primary visual cortex, but more anterior in the area between visual and temporal parietal areas. In fact, very much the area that lights up when you dream, which in gamma band produces a very well localized activity. Actually, Ray Ramirez made a beautiful picture of it that I have somewhere. So, yeah.
Given that there's a large portion of the cortex that's been knocked out in heavy neglect, you wouldn't expect to get 100% recovery from the caloric stimulation, right? So what is still missing after the caloric stimulation?
Beautiful question.
I have no idea.
But you are completely correct. You have lost a big chunk of stuff. The question is that at least the some of the cognitive events are now present. You recognize that there are two sides, right? Listen, there you go into a really beautiful area. I ask all my neurology colleagues, you know, what actually does happen when you stimulate? And this person is running around and so on. Isn't there some deficit? And you're basically getting rid of the basal ganglia. I mean, are the basal ganglia good for nothing?
You do get deficits. I mean, what you see is just a beautiful recovery, but you're seeing compensation also by other systems other than the basal ganglia. So if you take the basal ganglia out, I mean, it does have key functions that other systems cannot compensate for. So if you look at certain bimanual actions, even with STN, DBS, you get deficits. In fact, it can hurt bimanual function. And in certain kinds of sensory motor learning, it doesn't come, it's not normalized. I mean, it's a wonderful improvement, but it's not normal.
Well, you know, the difference between being able to move by yourself and not being able to move is obviously correct, no question. But, you know, I'm so delighted. This is something I didn't know. I've been saying, you know, what happens if you happen to have somebody who's, let's say, a terrific pianist, a concert pianist, and hits Parkinson's, and then you make a lesion, you put an electric, how well does he play? The answer is nobody knows. Apparently, nobody's done the experiments other than yourself, or at least it's the first time I hear. It makes a lot of sense. So yes, there is something. At this point, you know, I personally don't know.
So if your hypothesis is right, that it's arrhythmic activity is being generated in the thalamus, and the T-current is critically involved, then by blocking the T-current, by taking a drug, and we know there are some that are taken by petit mal patients, then you should see some of the symptoms alleviated.
Aren't you lovely? Yes. But there is this is a really story that I love, and it is the following. One of the things that ameliorates, that reduces a little bit the excitability of T channels is alcohol. So one fantasizes that the reason what we love alcohol, as we do, and we have been drinking it for the last 30,000 years or whatever, is that you're feeling a little bad, you have a little problem, you take a little alcohol, it reduces a little bit your T-channel activity, and if you have a little tremor, it disappears. People who have tremor know that. If you're a little bit sad, it makes you better. Yeah, it makes you a little bit more normal. So, yes, apparently. Yes, it's absolutely.
Very good. Harvey?
Yeah, the caloric stimulation is most fascinating. There's another structure which you may have heard of called the cerebellum. Actually, in your vestibular stimulation, you certainly recruit cerebellum, which has special...
No, listen, I didn't go there, but it's in fact completely correct. As you well know, the issue is that one of the few ways into the midline thalamus is, in fact, through the cerebellar nuclei. So it's perfect. You stimulate the thing, you stimulate the cerebellar nuclei, and basically you are depolarizing.
Yeah, but also, we tend not to think of cerebellum at a cognitive level.
Excuse
me? There are many people who have suggested that, I think. I can't remember the name.
No, I
enough of stimulus.
Yeah, well, you know, I asked...
But on a serious level, though. In terms of by activating the stimulus system, you are actually recruiting areas of the cerebellum that also have sensory motor maps.
Absolutely. And that actually go to both, of course, as we well know, to the specific as well as the non-specific system.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. So this is indeed very, very intriguing. Now, I ask whether I could talk about the cerebellum, but apparently they didn't offer me 2 hours. So the cerebellum was
two
accidentally...
More.
Why are you so rude? Huh? I thought it was only half an hour. Okay.
Can anyone want two more questions. Okay, yes.
Is there an area and a dysrhythmia associated with ADHD?
Yeah. It's being the story at the moment is really trying to establish some order, because the things that are happening now are very practical. People are considering surgical treatments, and people are considering, I think more importantly, for diagnostic issues, transcranial stimulation. And so I was recently invited to give a talk. I'm not going to tell you where, because it's not nice. And then somebody says, now, is there a sweet spot to stimulate for whatever? He says, don't ask me about sweet. This is awful. You come in, my dear friend, the neurosurgeon, says, is there a place I can lower an electrode, and that would be the end of that problem? You know, lack of memory, aging, whatever. He says, no. let's get organized. But it is true. I mean, what I'm saying is, it is indeed the case that it's making an enormous difference. As you probably all know, deep brain stimulation was considered by NIH's biggest breakthrough in the neurological field for the last 50 years or whatever, because people who were incapacitated with a terrible type of life were incredibly improved by it. So this is good. That's something that makes our day much nicer. We can not only just have fun, but we can actually do some good having fun.
Okay, well, with that, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.